Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is a Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 18th of June, these are our main stories. The former Egyptian president, Mohamed Morsi, dies after fainting in a Cairo courtroom where he was being tried on charges of espionage. A prominent Islamist, he was deposed by the military in 2013. The Chinese president, Xi Jinping, will make a rare visit to North Korea this week. We'll hear about its significance from our Asia-Pacific editor. One woman's campaign to save the hammerhead shark, a delicacy for some.
The ceviche, which is a national plate, is made by hammerheads. So this is incredible, you know, because you don't eat a jaguar or a panda.
Also in this podcast, efforts to keep alive some of the dozens of indigenous languages in Australia. And the American fashion designer, heiress and artist Gloria Vanderbilt has died at the age of 95. 7 years ago, he became president of Egypt. Within a year, he had been overthrown by the army. Now Mohamed Morsi has died. The former head of state, who faced charges of espionage, fainted in court and died later in hospital. Murad Shashani from our Arabic service told me what happened.
What we heard, now we have the version that the authorities in Egypt just released in a statement saying that after he asked to talk to the court, 5 minutes after he gave his sort of testimony or speech, then he fainted, collapsed in the court, then he was taken to hospital, checked, then they announced he's dead. By then, the authorities said there was no kind of any bad treatment to him and nothing appeared in his body, no physical touches, etc. You know, this formal jargon of reporting that way. However, we've been hearing a sort of loads of reaction coming, depends on from the places where many people were sending critical messages to Egyptian authorities, beginning with the Human Rights Watch and the human rights organizations that saying his family were not allowed to visit him, as well as he wasn't given the proper medical care. On other hand, we've hearing tweets from Qatar and Kuwait, which reflects the sort of division towards when we talk about Egypt in the Middle East between these countries, Qatar and Turkey on a side, and Egypt with his alliance in Saudi Arabia, Emirates, etc., which having these strong positions against Muslim Brotherhood.
He served as president at a very critical time, just after all of the protests in Tahrir Square and the big change then. How will he be remembered?
Mohamed Morsi, 67-year-old, now he was the first elected president after the Arab Spring. Many of his fans or supporters tend to describe him the first elected democratically leader in Egypt. However, we need to remember that there was the first time where Muslim Brotherhoods as a group ruling a country in Arab world and a big country like Egypt. Also need to remember that, and I'm talking here as a Muslim Brotherhood, not Islamist, because we have other experiences in the Middle East. His supporters will look always, he's that the representative of the legitimacy, if you like, and that was the slogan. On other hand, many people said he was trying to sort of Islamize Egypt, and that was led to a protest against him. But however, we know Egypt now is divided between even defining the moment in the 2013, was it a coup or a revolution? And it's really a fierce division, if you like, still deep in Egypt.
Murad Shashani of BBC Arabic. It's been announced that the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, will arrive in North Korea on Thursday for a two-day visit, his first official trip to the country since he came to power in 2012. Mr. Xi will hold talks with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, a week before the G20 summit in Japan, where he's expected to meet U.S. President Donald Trump. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton, told me why the visit was so significant.
This meeting is all about timing. It comes just as both North Korea and China are really suffering in their relationships with the United States. And so for both of them, this is a great time for them to meet up and to underline the fact that they are historic allies and they help each other out. So the key point for Xi Jinping is that this comes just before he is supposed to be heading to the G20 summit in Japan. We are expecting that he will meet with the U.S. President President Donald Trump on the sidelines of that summit. And really, he was supposed to be walking into that meeting with Donald Trump really on the back foot. He's dealing with a worsening U.S.-China trade war. He's been really at the receiving end of a lot of criticism because of ongoing protests in Hong Kong. Things are not looking great for Xi Jinping right now. The North Korea card is the one card he can play. It's the one thing he really has over Donald Trump, because he can just emphasize that China and North Korea have a relationship going back decades. China is North Korea's only ally, and he can play that card before he arrives in Japan. North Korea, it needs money. It's at the receiving end of brutal sanctions that it's suffering because of its deteriorating relationship with the United States. And this is a good time for North Korea to be amplifying its relationship with China and basically showing Washington that, look, China can weaken these sanctions, can soften these sanctions by giving us food and fuel aid. Both of them want Donald Trump to be paying attention.
You say he's playing his card by going to North Korea to meet Kim Jong-un, but Donald Trump also does this, doesn't he? Because he mentions another letter that he received. So it's almost like they're both Xi Jinping and Donald Trump with North Korea. It seems to be that Kim Jong-un is a bridge between them or something.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. I was just looking at the language that the Chinese state media has been using to describe the relationship between China and North Korea. And really, it's very special. They say that Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un, this is a crucial move to usher in a new chapter for their ties in their 70th anniversary, carrying forward the camaraderie and brotherhood forged through the historical sacrifice of lives and blood. I mean, this is really Chinese state media language, but they're really trying to amplify this relationship and really to kind of point out that the relationship between Pyongyang and Washington is quite weak and is quite vulnerable. This one, the relationship between Beijing and Pyongyang, is much stronger, much more stable.
Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton. Although they're protected by international wildlife laws, pangolins are the most poached mammals in the world, and they're trafficked for their meat and scales. In Uganda, Moses Adinetwe, a local, spends much of his time rescuing the elusive creatures. He's been speaking to Christophe Farah.
The pangolins, some people when they look at them, they think maybe they are snakes or maybe they are big rats, but they are animals that have scales all over their body. And they have the tongue, a long tongue, that helps them in feeding. And they feed on ants and termites. And usually they move at night because they most of the time feed at night. Sometimes even during the day, you can happen to see them.
I understand that people eat them as a delicacy. Is that right?
I've met some people here who say they have eaten them and they were saying that, oh, they are so, so sweet, so delicious. Well, I have never tasted them, but I have heard many people here say so. After eating them, sometimes they are getting the scales, and the scales, you know, are sold maybe to China or any other countries.
What do you have to say to fellow Ugandans who eat and also sell the scales of the pangolin?
I would tell my fellow Ugandan that there are many ways we can benefit from them other than eating them or selling their scales. For example, we have the tourism. Many people all over the world have never seen a pangolin. So many people in the future will want to see a pangolin, and they will pay money to come and see pangolins. Most of us here are farmers, so they have a great work that they do for us that many people don't know. They are anteaters and insects and termites. They help us when they eat them and defecate somewhere that remains there, and that's manure. And also they help in controlling the ants, you know, other insects and termites like that.
I understand that you've been saving pangolins. How many have you saved so far?
So far, I have saved 20 pangolins. I have been trying to save the pangolins for over 3 years now.
And how do you manage to track those animals that are in danger?
I go into the communities teaching the people about wildlife conservation, especially the pangolins and what's happening with them. Some people, when they hear about that, they say, oh, the other day somebody killed a pangolin. The other day someone was, you know, captured one. Then I tell them, please, when next time you see something like that happening, please let me know. When it happens, they see someone having one, then they call me. So I send there some people to go there and talk to the one who's having them. They talk to them, they explain to them. Then at times they hand them over to them, then they bring them to me. And if they don't, then I call the rangers. We go there for an arrest. until we save the pangolin.
What could have been the most memorable moment in your quest to save pangolins?
It was actually last week when I saved the pangolin with a small baby. I got a call from one of my informants on the Uganda-Congo border that someone was trying to sell the pangolin with a baby. I had to rush there and talk to the people who were holding it. I explained to them everything and told them, please, these animals need to live. And they were like, oh, no, we want to sell them. I said, no. I explained and explained until they came to understand. Then they gave the pangolins to me until I called the rangers to come and pick them for release. I had never seen a pangolin with a baby, and I was very, very happy when I saved the two of them.
Moses Adinetwe speaking to Christoph Farah. Australia was once home to about 300 different indigenous languages, but only a dozen or so are still being handed down to children. The rest have either died or are critically endangered. But as our correspondent Hal Griffith reports, efforts are being made to try to keep them alive. He's been to the Kimberley region of Western Australia to meet the last fluent speakers of Miriwong.
Punjang, so which one's Punjang? Ah, this.
On the steep walk up to a lookout over the town of Kununurra, I'm being given a lesson on native plant life.
Is there a Miriwong name for the plant?
Maling.
Maling. We'll have some maling to keep me going. Get energy up the mountain.
Don't swallow it.
Don't swallow it? Oh, you should have said that before.
My guides are Agnes and David, two of the surviving speakers of Miriwong, a language which for tens of thousands of years has helped to describe this dry, dramatic landscape to its people.
Yeah. A lot of things here that we can only describe in Miriwong. It's something that we're part of. I mean, wherever you go, out in the bush, you know, there's language all around you. Everything we see has language. You know, everything that moves, the food and the waters, rivers, they all have names. It's something that a lot of people can't even describe today in English, you know.
Around half of Australia's indigenous languages were wiped out after European colonisation. Another 100, like Miriwong, are listed as critically endangered. But a small, dedicated team is trying to save it by teaching a new generation.
My favourite word in Miriwong is Juwinyan. And that means crocodile.
My favourite Miriwong word is gaigai, which means grandma.
My favourite word in Miriwong is widjawidjab, that means swimming.
Every week, 400 children in local primary schools have lessons like this, regardless of whether they have Aboriginal heritage. Roseanne Bilminga has been leading today's class.
Hopefully they share it with others. I mean, like, their family members, and hopefully they take it back home and teach their parents, their friends. Yeah.
So the children are the ones who teach the older generation?
Yeah, that's what I mean. The children, hopefully they teach the older generation, and you know, they're the next generation to grow this language up.
Listen up, let's talk some Miriwong.
Growing the language means making it useful and accessible. A Miriwong radio show tries to achieve that. Knut Olowski is a German linguist who, for over a decade, has been working with the Miriwong people, helping them reclaim their language.
There is research that says Indigenous people learning their ancestral language, they are more likely to get a job, they're more likely to attend school. They're also less likely to struggle with substance abuse. They're less likely to commit serious crimes. Language means identity.
The linguist Knut Olowski ending that report by Hal Griffith in Western Australia. Our next story is somewhat unusual. It's about a marine biologist leading a mission to save the hammerhead shark. Ileana Zaneya is the co-founder of the Costa Rican non-profit organization Misión Tiburón, the Spanish word for shark. Our science correspondent, Helen Briggs, went to meet her.
Not many of us get to swim with sharks, and some of us wouldn't want to, but she wants to point out some of the myths about sharks, which are they're not all man-eating creatures, they're not all attacking humans, and she had this life-changing experience when she swam with sharks.
The first time that I dove with the hammerheads was such an incredible experience for me. I think there are this kind of experience that change your life. When I was surrounded by them, I see they are so beautiful, and it was curious because at the same time, I also see that they are very vulnerable, and I decided to dedicate my work and myself to the protection of hammerheads.
In Costa Rica and in other places, people eat these things.
That's right, yes. She came across sharks being used as fishing bait and also being eaten as part of the national dish, and she's really worried about that.
The ceviche, which is a national plate, is very common that it is made by juveniles of hammerheads. So this is incredible, you know, because you don't eat a jaguar or a panda. It's an endangered species. And we need to change this vision that we have of sharks, because I think this is happening because most of the people see sharks as fishing resources.
What's she going to do about this?
Well, there's a lot of conservation work going on to look at where sharks are found, and there are protected areas for the adults of sharks where they congregate around the Cocos Island and Galapagos Islands. But she found that the sharks were going inland to coastal areas to breed and raise their young. So she did research that led to a shark sanctuary just off the coast of Costa Rica where sharks come to raise their young, and there are fish restrictions in place for part of that. And she says that's the way forward, to look at the whole life cycle of the shark, not just the adults, but where they go to breed, and then put necessary protections in place.
Helen Briggs. Still to come in this podcast.
The VR is a life-size volumetric performance to audiences in a communal VR experience.
Virtual reality theatre becomes actual reality in London. The chief executive of Ethiopian Airlines has rejected claims that pilot error was a factor in a crash in which 157 people were killed earlier this year. The accident, shortly after takeoff from Addis Ababa in March, involved a Boeing 737 MAX. All the planes are currently grounded around the world. Theo Leggett reports.
Boeing has already admitted that the 737 MAX has a problem. The cause of the accident is widely believed to be faulty computer software, which forced the nose of the aircraft down when the pilots were attempting to make it climb. The same issue is believed to have caused another 737 MAX to crash into the sea off Indonesia last year, killing 189 people. But at a hearing in Washington last month, a leading congressman, Sam Graves, insisted that pilot error was a factor in the crash. And the acting head of the US aviation regulator, the FAA, appeared to agree with him. But Ethiopian Airlines chief executive Tewolde Gebremariam told the BBC the congressman was severely misinformed or did not have the facts. He said the official investigation had made it clear the crew were not responsible for the accident. Asked who was really to blame, he said 380 aircraft had been grounded around the world, and the facts spoke for themselves.
Theo Leggett. The Canadian province of Quebec has overhauled its immigration system with the passage of a controversial new law. It's a move that opponents have described as a step in the wrong direction for multiculturalism. Our correspondent, Peter Goffin, explains how the new law will work.
It fast-tracks applications by skilled workers. That's people with higher levels of education, who speak French, and who have already been working in Quebec. And it's also supposed to help match skilled immigrants to current needs in the job market and cut wait times. Now, Canada has a similar program at the federal level, and there is criticism that this unfairly gives preference to more affluent applicants. But the biggest controversy here is that under this new law, about 16,000 pending applications started under the old system are going to be scrapped, and the applicants and their families, about 50,000 people overall, will have to start all over again under the new rules.
And this isn't the only controversial step being taken by Quebec, is it?
No, not at all. Now, this bill also allows Quebec to install a so-called values test for people who want to become permanent residents. And critics are worried that test could become a tool for them to weed out applicants who don't come from white Christian backgrounds. And then there's a separate bill that Quebec's trying to put through that would ban the wearing of religious symbols by government workers. And opponents have said that law unfairly targets Muslims, especially women who wear veils or headscarves.
And this all seems rather at odds with Canada's multicultural image.
It is, but Quebec has traditionally set itself apart from the rest of Canada, and it's very protective of what it sees as its own unique identity. It's the only province in Canada that has French as its official language, and it's actually been declared its own nation within the country of Canada. And like a lot of places around the world, Canada is seeing a rightward shift in its provincial politics. The party that's in charge of Quebec won a majority last year promising to implement these laws, and as the Premier François Legault said, "I'm doing exactly what the people want me to do."
Peter Goffin speaking there to Alex Ritson. The American heiress, writer, painter, and designer Gloria Vanderbilt has died at the age of 95. She was born into one of the richest families in U.S. history, the great-great-granddaughter of the railway and shipping tycoon Cornelius Vanderbilt. Her son, the CNN news anchor Anderson Cooper, announced that she had died of stomach cancer and described her as an extraordinary woman who lived her life on her own terms. Our correspondent, Chris Buckler, sent this report from New York.
Gloria Vanderbilt was born into enormous wealth and almost straight into the headlines. Before she was 2 years old, her father died and her mother took her to Europe, prompting a custody battle in which Gloria was portrayed as the poor little rich girl. Her aunt said her mother was using her trust fund to pay for a freewheeling, lavish lifestyle. The court case made the papers with scandalous accusations and character witnesses from high society. In the end, she was taken from her mother, and Gloria Vanderbilt said that started a long quest for love and approval. There were romances with Frank Sinatra, Marlon Brando and Howard Hughes, and marriages to, among others, the director Sidney Lumet and the writer Wyatt Cooper.
I'm always in love. And I think everybody should always be in love. And if it's not, of course, a person is ideal. But if not, you have to have joy in looking at a flower and the sun.
She was at various times an actress, an author and a fashion designer. In the 1970s, tight-fitting jeans, which bore her name and signature, were a must-have for many style-conscious women.
They're the upper strata. They're the jeans. With a social status, girls with private jets and with fancy pets think they're tops.
But amid all the success, there was a tragedy, which Gloria Vanderbilt said stripped her bare. In 1988, her son Carter threw himself from the family's 14th floor apartment in New York in front of her. Another of her sons, the CNN journalist Anderson Cooper, reflected on the effect of his death in an HBO documentary he made with his mother.
Some people are sucked under by tragedy and loss, and it destroys them. And some people, it propels them forward. And I think it certainly has my mom, and it certainly has with me.
In a statement announcing her death, Anderson Cooper said his mother was 95 years old, but that anyone close to her would have told you that Gloria Vanderbilt was the youngest, coolest, most modern person they knew.
Chris Buckler in New York. Now, if you've ever watched a dog look at you with sad puppy eyes, you may have felt your heart swell with affection for it. Well, apparently, there's a scientific reason for that. Researchers in Britain and America have found that dogs evolved this expression over thousands of years in order to get on better with humans. Here's Richard Hamilton.
Scientists at the University of Portsmouth and Duquesne University in Pittsburgh looked at the behavioural differences between dogs and wolves. Their results suggest that dogs' facial structures changed over time to enable them to interact better with humans. They think that the sad puppy dog expression triggers a nurturing response in us because it makes the dog's eyes seem larger, more childlike, and similar to the expressions we produce when we're sad. Professor Anne Burrows from Duquesne University compared the facial anatomy of domestic dogs with that of wolves. she found that the levator muscle that allows a dog to raise its inner eyebrows is actually very small in wolves.
Humans valued the facial movement produced by that levator muscle during the dog domestication process. That facial expression was somehow selected by humans as being of value to them, whether it was conscious or subconscious. This muscle function was important enough that domestic dogs evolved it in a very short period of time. 30 to 35,000 years is what we think about as the time it took for dogs to evolve, and that's very rapid. So in a short period of time, humans selected for this muscle movement.
The British researchers found that when exposed to a human for 2 minutes, dogs raised these inner eyebrows more and at higher intensities than wolves. In evolutionary terms, this behaviour seems to give dogs a selection advantage over other species and reinforces the puppy dog eyes trait for future generations of man's best friend.
Richard Hamilton. For some time now, theatre fans have been predicting that VR, or virtual reality, would soon be playing a major role in the arts, both on stage and on screen. Now visitors to the National Theatre in London can experience a 10-minute film presentation that will run up to 30 times a day. This report from our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd.
Take a look at my spice rack. Colour and flavour of England. Overtime of...
All Kinds of Limbo is inspired by a current hit at the National Theatre, Small Island. The play features real live actors. This digital offshoot is an attempt to edge virtual reality a bit towards the mainstream. Toby Coffey runs the National's VR operation.
The VR is a life-size volumetric performance to audiences in a communal VR experience. So you're in the same space as the performer and you're free to move around the space with fellow audiences. 6 scenes, 4 costume changes throughout a 10-minute experience.
Love you just as I do. Let me show.
With headset and headphones on, you encounter various full-size and convincing digital versions of performer Nubia Brandon, who also co-wrote the score, commissioned to explore how the influence of Caribbean music has played out in the UK.
You're going to be going through essentially a timeline of... and it travels through different scenes and different characters. All those characters that I've created are all parts of me that are always with me when I perform.
In a confusing landscape such as this, you can see why.
All this in the theatre lobbies and shown to 30 people at a time. All Kinds of Limbo will run in London for 3 months. Tens of thousands of people will discover VR for the first time. And some, the National Theatre expects, may be converted to the cause.
Vincent Dowd reporting, and that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.